Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the London School of Economics. My name is Silvana Tenreiro. I'm a professor of economics, and I'm delighted to welcome Professor Alan Taylor, who will give his lecture today on the natural rate of interest. Alan is professor at Columbia University's School of International and Policy Affairs and an external member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee. As you know, Alan is a super prolific scholar with influential papers spanning many fields from international economics, macroeconomics, finance and economic history. Born in Wakefield, Alan studied mathematics at King's College, Cambridge, before graduating with a PhD in economics from Harvard University. Alan has also been a consultant or visitor at many public sector organizations, including the IMF, the World Bank, the BIS, several national central banks and regional Federal Reserve Banks. He worked as a senior advisor at Morgan Stanley and at PIMCO and as a consultant for various asset managers. So as it is quite evident, he has a lot to bring to the discussion of the natural interest rate and monetary policy. Now, before giving the floor to Alan, I'll turn to housekeeping. For those on Twitter, the hashtag for today's event is #LSEEvents. The event is being recorded and will be made available as a podcast subject to technical difficulties. There will be a chance to put your questions, both for both of you in the audience and those online, but we'll wait for that and we'll listen to Alan, who will speak for about 40 minutes. And welcome again. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Silvana, for the kind introduction, and thank you for the invitation to be at LSE tonight. I'm delighted to be here to give my second speech as a member of the Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of England, where I joined last September. And of course, LSE is a special place in terms of its history with the Bank of England going back many decades, but since 1997, it has also been the academic home to many distinguished members of the MPC, to name a few: Mervyn King, Charles Goodhart, Stephen Nicol, Charlie Bean, Tim Besley, and of course, Silvana, as well as my current colleague on the committee, Swati Dhingra. And their service sets a great example and provides inspiration for me as just the latest professor to serve on the MPC. So thank you. Now, let me begin by saying that the meta subject of practically any speech by a monetary policymaker is communication. And if communication is perfectly successful, then ideally everyone can predict almost without fail the actions that you will take, as well as in most likely future states of the world. Now, the actual subject of my speech today, given the title, is the end of the road. But if you're asking yourself, the end of the road for what? Then I've probably fallen short of that communications benchmark. But at least that leaves me with something to talk about tonight. So to cut to the point, the end of the road that I will be speaking about is the end of the road for bank rate, or for our policy interest rate, our main policy instrument. And that end point is that end of the road is also known as the end point or the neutral rate. Now, that destination, that end point, where it is and how we get there is of enormous interest, not just to me. It's of enormous interest and consequence for the economy, affecting financial markets, banks, firms, households, everyone. This raises further questions. Is it really that important? And if so, where is it? I believe it is important, and that trying to avoid the question is hard, it's problematic, and possibly counterproductive, in my opinion. So I'll try to explain why that is, and I'll then try to answer the question of where it is as directly as I can by providing my own view, which is, of course, not necessarily the view of my MPC colleagues. So let me start with some hopefully useful historical context. We can start by looking at the recent path of short-term rates, of inflation, of the output gap, which is an estimate of the balance between supply and demand in the economy, as well as an estimate of the natural rate, or R-star, in the UK over the last 50 years. The question, of course, is why these trends happened, and then where might they go next? And that's coming. It'll take a few steps to get there. And also we'll need to get have an attempt to get a handle on the underlying economics and some of the relevant historical evidence. But let's start here. As chart one shows, the bank's policy rate, bank rate, has been on a downward trend for 50 years, notwithstanding some major fluctuations around that trend. Part of it can be attributed to the fall in the real natural rate of interest, which went from about 3% in the 1980s to near 1% now. Over that time, also, inflation has come down from the 1970s level when it was at its heights, and is settling around 2%, the MPC's target, but with a lot of noisy fluctuations along the way. So bank rate is up there at its highest levels in the 1980s, a time when all major central banks sought to put an end to a long inflation surge. Inflation had been allowed to get out of control in the 1970s, getting into double digits on an annual basis. That 10% plus inflation, unleashed by loose monetary policy, was painful, it was unpopular, as was the 10% unemployment that followed. And in an already dismal science, it bequeathed new terms of art, such as stagflation and the misery index, the latter being the sum of inflation and unemployment. That number eventually rose into the 20% plus range at times. Now, thankfully, we never saw that kind of misery index again, but the macroeconomic aftershocks left a big mark on economists and on economic policy. By the 1990s, in a growing range of advanced economies, we saw the emergence of the current framework of inflation targeting by an independent central bank. Yet that period of subsequent macroeconomic calm was fleeting. It would last for barely 20 years until 2008, that time being wistfully referred to by macroeconomists as the Great Moderation. In that window, inflation settled at low and stable levels. Economic growth hummed along. Policy interest rates remained on a mostly steady course and in a fairly stable channel. It was nice, as Mervyn and Ben have said on numerous occasions. Bank rate began this current century at a relatively high rate of 5.75%, falling to 3.5% in mid-2003 and tightening a little bit before the financial crisis in 2008. But immediately thereafter, rates fell to near zero and would remain there for most of the decade that followed. Subsequent economic growth was weak, and many parts of the world entered a long and deep recession. In that period after the financial crisis, UK inflation was volatile and often meaningfully above and even below target. However, interest rates on the floor at zero was not seen as normal, certainly not normal, in the long run. And the question was, what would happen next? Some advanced economies began to raise interest rates off the zero floor in the late 2010s as economies recovered. But then the pandemic hit. The economy was at the risk of collapse. Central banks supported the economy, as did fiscal measures. The interest rate went back to the floor once again. And at the exit from the pandemic, inflation began to rise as supply chains struggled to meet resurgent demand, and then took off after food and energy shocks triggered by the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So in that context, bank rate, like interest rates across the world, swung from very accommodative to very restrictive, to push back against inflation dynamics and the risk of expectations and anchoring. So that's a brief summary of events in the last 50 years, and it's pretty clear that, at least since 2008, interest rates here in the UK, as well as in other parts of the world, have hardly ever been near their neutral level. And for good reason. The emergence of one shock after another has required central banks to intervene resolutely, first in one direction and then in the other. As a result, and possibly unlike the period before 2008, it's very hard to simply look at the policy rate itself and take some kind of average or trend and draw any firm conclusions as to where neutral might be. So what can we do? Tonight I will walk through the kind of analytical approach that most macroeconomists would typically use as of now, the current best practice as I see it, and I'll try to explain how that guides my thinking. However, I think first we're going to take a bit of a dive into history. And now's a good time to do that. So we're not going to look at 50 years. We're going to briefly look at 800 years. Why? Not for the sake of it, but because I think it provides us with further insights and motivation to ponder the question of what drives interest rates today and maybe in the future. The history of interest rates is very long indeed, and it should prompt us to ask what key economic mechanisms have mattered over the very long run, and to think about how they've ebbed and flowed in terms of their influence in different times and different places. Now, this chart is a remarkable figure from a remarkable data set, one that was constructed by Paul Schmelzing, who is a financial and economic historian. He worked for a time at the Bank of England, and he contributed this work to the bank's data archive. So if you get excited or you're a little bit insomniac at 2 in the morning, download the data and, you know, it might help you get sleep. I mean, strictly, I suppose, as an economic historian, I should say going from 50 to 800 years leaves us still with something of a subsample, if you're really picky. There are interest rates from even earlier periods, going back several thousand years. I think one of my predecessors, Andy Haldane, once gave a speech with 3,000 years of interest rates. And, of course, there are these, you know, inscriptions on clay tablets and papyri. And it turns out a lot of the ancient records that we have turn out to be records of economic matters, including debt contracts, many of them. So debt and therefore interest rates and many of the foundations of modern finance actually go way back for millennia to ancient civilizations. So, but in terms of having a cleaned, codified, and somewhat standardized time series of interest rates over several centuries, this work of Schmelzing is unique and stands out as being especially useful to us because it presents a continuous study that goes all the way up to present times. What are these interest rates? Well, he records the interest rates on debt issued by sovereigns, princes, churches, charities, other debtors, which might be historically the closest thing we have, closest analogues, if you like, to today's benchmark safe asset issuers. And what, of course, stands out from this picture, first and foremost, as the central message, is this: interest rates have been declining for not just 50 years, but for 800 years. So I want to briefly ask why, take a tour of the history, and see how the different parts of the story fit together and might inform our way of thinking about where interest rates are today, where they might go next. So the key parts of any good economic history argument are: do you have the data, do you have the historical narrative, and do you have the theory? If you can build a story around those three pillars, those three legs, that's a good way to go. So I'll briefly go through a historical timeline, I'll jump into theory, and then I'll jump back to history, and then come back to the present to try and convince you of the analytical threads that maybe run through all of that timeline, and then we'll get to what comes next. Okay, for this, and in an act of gross simplification, which is what economists do, let me divide this 800-year period into four great epochs and talk about them. The pre-modern period, which I will take to mean the Malthusian era, before the onset of the full steam industrial revolution, as it were, and before the broad development of modern financial markets after 1800. Then the long 19th century, with growth accelerating up to 1914 via industrial development, financial deepening, the first era of globalization, and the first demographic shifts. Then the short 20th century, beginning with war, depression, war again, and followed by a slow reconstruction of economic and financial structures nationally and globally, and also the second demographic shift going on up to the 1990s. And then where we are now, the 21st century so far, accelerated globalization and financialization, a third demographic shift of pronounced aging, and continued wealth accumulation, and slower growth, at least so far. So let me look at each of these four epochs in turn, try to interpret them through an economic lens. But before I can do that, I said we'd need some theoretical structure. So let me try and build up a theoretical toolkit and then come back to the historical story. What's our theoretical setup going to be? Well, we're at London School of Economics. We're going to have supply and demand, yep. This is a very simple, stylized view of the determinants of saving supply and investment demand in an economy populated by savers and borrowers. For savers, think households on net, or those acting on their behalf, supplying funds for the loan market. For borrowers, think of firms on net, borrowing funds in these markets to invest in productive assets that will be the basis of economic growth. In this simple picture, it's just a single economy now closed for the time being. We can extend that in a moment. So the diagram shows the interaction between households' supply of funds and firms' demand for funds. The horizontal axis is the quantity of saving and investment. The vertical axis is the price, the real interest rate. Think of it as being the nominal rate minus inflation, the real cost of borrowing. As real rates increase, savers are incentivized to save more by higher rates, but borrowers are similarly incentivized to invest less given the high cost of the hurdle rate of the borrowed funds. So savings curve slopes down, investment demand curve slopes, savings curve supplies up, slopes up, investment demand curve slopes down. I just failed my own exam. So there will not be a test later. Now we think of the intersection point in this picture as the steady state equilibrium, one with full employment, stable inflation, and where savings equal investment, so that this simple financial market has demand equal to supply. In that case, the equilibrium real rate is what we usually call the natural rate, famously known by that symbol R star. So that's the real interest rate that results when all shocks to the economy, both real and nominal, all shocks have fully dissipated. If you think those conditions never obtain, you're right. Shocks never fully dissipate, as you may have noticed, and there are always new ones coming along. So this picture and this equilibrium and that point and that R star will never be seen, and thus R star is not an observable concept. But despite that, R star is still a very real economic object, and it's one of great importance. It's the central tendency of the real interest rate, the mean towards which we are always reverting. So in the very long run, even if the shocks move the real rate around in the short run, we should see real rates on average tending to steer closer to R star. And so now going back to our historical problem, we can ask, how is this model useful? And that means asking, what are the relevant shifts in the drivers of saving supply and investment demand that might move R star? And what might have made them change over the course of history? So let me list a few prime candidates, six candidates, historical movers that economic research has identified as relevant for this question. So I'm going to go through them in pairs. First one, property rights. I mean, when you're saving and giving your money to someone, and they're maybe giving it to someone else, and it's going to an end investment, you might wonder, will I get my money back? How much? Savers may feel less certain that they will receive the amount they've been promised. If so, property rights are weak. Might include the rule of law and contract enforcement. This is like a contractual mechanism. Point two, financial frictions. Banks or other market participants might become less efficient or competitive, and so that's like an intermediation mechanism. So let me show that on this figure. That's as if there's a cost translating what savers want to supply into what borrowers can get. There's going to be some tax or some wedge due to these frictions. Property rights are weak, you demand therefore some compensation for that risk, or intermediaries are not efficient, so there's some cost of getting the savings from the savers to the borrowers. The effect of that is to move the effective savings supply up by that cost or friction and move you to a higher R star in the end. Two more mechanisms. People for some reason want to save more, and firms maybe invest less out of caution. This is another dimension of risk. They're more afraid in this riskier economic environment. That's a risk or an uncertainty mechanism. Mechanism four, people want to save more. Firms want to invest less because growth prospects are weaker. If growth was great, you know, and you're a firm, you want to invest. And if you're a saver and you think growth is great, why bother saving? You've got great prospects coming. You may want to borrow against them. I'm going to be rich tomorrow. I'd like to borrow for that bigger house or a bigger car or something. So these are simultaneous shocks to demand and supply. In this case, lower growth or a riskier environment disincentivizes investment and may encourage precautionary saving or saving for a slower growth future. Here it's interesting that the effect on quantities is somewhat ambiguous, but the effect on the real interest rate is unambiguous. It's pushing it down. Last two mechanisms. People want to or can afford to save more for future needs due to, say, a higher propensity to save out of higher incomes or maybe fewer children or longer expected life or retirement. That's sort of a collection of demographic mechanisms. Or lastly, six, if we think beyond the single economy and think of a world in which this economy lives, there may be some external forms of saving supply, capital inflows into the economy, which increase the available funds for use at home. And that's sort of a global spillover mechanism. Okay, that's the last one here. Savings are just being supplied in greater quantities, either from abroad or out of a demographic mechanism at home that's encouraging more saving. Okay, so those are my six drivers of our star in the long run. And there may be some other mechanisms, and we can talk about that, and Q&A will be a great time to discuss some of those, maybe, if you want. But in each case, they've given us some directional guidance. It's a simple set of theoretical mechanisms, but it gives us some guidance as to how interest rates might have been affected over the long run. So now I'm going to try and translate those theoretical mechanisms into history. I'm going to try and look at history through the lens of this theory. So let me now dive back into history and try to give an account of the last 800 years using that theoretical toolkit. So let's turn to the first epoch, which is highlighted here, from the Middle Ages to the 1800s in Europe, which is where the data set comes from. I'll try and make some special attention to the UK or Britain or even England as it was then. So this is the pre-industrial era. Growth was slow, so we've got the slow growth mechanism kicking in. Productivity advance was minimal. The population was often in Malthusian stasis. Incomes and wealth were low for the vast majority of people. Few had much beyond subsistence. Financial intermediation was in a weak state or almost non-existent until the 1700s, and somewhat embryonic even then. Investment opportunities and sources of savings were repressed, so then the question remains, what kept the interest rate so high as measured? And I think the answer lies in the first and second mechanisms that we considered a moment ago. Financial frictions were very high, given the primitive state of banking and capital markets. Perhaps even more of a binding constraint was the often unreliable nature of financial contracts. So that was a world, the Middle Ages, of often arbitrary property rights, weak rule of law. Returns were never sure. Confiscation or default risks were high. The investor in a project might not see the payoff, and any payoff might not translate into the repayment to the lender. That meant a risk premium, a friction that would end up in the price, in the equilibrium real rate, R star. Now, only over many, many centuries would that institutional environment change, very gradually. In British history, we think of dates like 1215 or 1688 and many other points along the road. For even just the most basic financial channels to function reasonably smoothly, institutions needed to change. And I'll refer here to the words of an economic historian, maybe an understudied one, Eric Jones. And according to him, these centuries didn't see a slew of technological advances. People weren't inventing machines and gadgets. Instead, it was the removal of impediments that were setting the stage for things to come. And he said the following: what was important, instead, was the slow planing away of roughness and risk, so that entrepreneurs might not merely maximize profits, but retain them too. And as interest rates were brought down, so choices among investments became technical exercises in deciding what the market demanded, rather than matters of guessing merely where it was least risky to hazard resources. The economy became regulated by economic rather than political decisions. So I think that's the story of the first epoch. It set the stage for what was to come next. the second epoch, from around 1800 to 1914, marking the onset of modern economic growth and global economic integration to follow. In Britain, after the war's end in 1815, the Industrial Revolution gathered steam in the first half of the 19th century. The first era of globalization took shape in the second half of the 19th century. The first demographic transition unleashed for a time a population boom. The financial sector grew to hitherto unprecedented size, and Britain led the way as the financial capital of the world in this era. The first true full-scale era of finance capitalism, I would say, which channeled savings into enterprise at home and then increasingly overseas. So both savings supply and investment demand were up relative to their moribund levels in centuries past. But which was pushing harder? How did rates move? Interest rates had briefly spiked upwards during the Napoleonic War, hardly a surprise, as it was a very expensive war. In fact, British government debt to GDP reached a peak of 213% at the end of that war. But after Waterloo, as time wore on, interest rates returned to their inexorable downward path that we saw. The great wave of savings was now in full flow, its pace running well ahead of the surging investment demands of even what was then a heavy industrial age. So through the lens of our models, I think we can interpret this as a combination of growth shocks, potentially raising our star, also global capital demand after 1870, capital being in demand for investment overseas, also potentially raising our star, but also a 19th century savings glut, if you will, at home. A continued diminution of risks and frictions in the financial sector as well, both of those tending to lower our star. And those latter forces were dominating. It was now a world made safe, or safer, for savers. And unsurprisingly, many more savers there would be. But that was also because at the same time, incomes rose and the economy had decisively broken out of the Malthusian trap. Initially, saving may have been the domain of only the very wealthy in previous centuries. But saving was now spreading to the middle classes, whose incomes were advancing far away from subsistence, and whose financial concerns would end up as grist for many a Victorian novel. So the sources of saving were growing rapidly at home. Interest rates fell further, and the downforces on our star were quite strong, even absorbing that increasing demand from the rest of the world after 1870. Let me now turn to the third epoch, the 20th century. And perhaps this ought to be broken up into two further halves, but okay, we're slicing the salami very thin at that point, at least for an economic historian. So if we're asking what could stop the downforce on interest rates, the first decades of war, depression, another war, did not cause a decisive break. They caused a lot of turbulence, a lot of volatility. Economic growth was subdued, and there was a shift to greater risk and economic and policy uncertainty. And that was maybe compounding an urge to save more and invest less during that time for precautionary motives. And I think those sentiments would be lodged for some time in the psyche and shape savers' financial behavior, even after 1945. I'd now think of my parents telling me, I'd never get into debt and, you know, be very careful and save and so forth. I'm now old enough that I'm you know, exuding that kind of boomer thinking. But that was the time, and it shaped people. That would very briefly change, chiefly for an unusual and time-specific demographic reason, the baby boom. This event, and through its subsequent echoes in the 70s and 80s, would momentarily boost investment and economic growth against an already rapid growth backdrop. And those expanding investment needs would, for a generation, just nose ahead of saving supply, a saving supply that was being held back a bit by the same growth and demographic mechanisms. Older children entered the workforce, which grew at a faster pace for a little while younger children put downward pressure on household savings. And in that moment, in that peacetime moment, the trend of 800 years was held in check and maybe pushed back a little bit. But that counter trend didn't last long. One reason was a downshift in growth rates after the 1970s, and an even bigger downforce derives from another demographic change, a permanent shift in our population patterns that endures today and into the infinite future, as far as we can see. Aging, the old person, right? And increasingly, as time has gone by, the old person with savings. And those savings were increasingly needed to finance the increasingly lengthy period of retirement in old age. That had simply never been much of a possibility in previous epochs, and which, beyond the baseline level, could not be provided out of state pension provision alone. And I think the continuation of those trends well describes the times we've been living in since the turn of the century and the fourth epoch, and I think will continue to dominate for some time. That savings glut of the old, as I would call it, has rolled on and on. The average wealth of aging individuals seems to rise with age, not fall, as was pointed out by my former MPC predecessor, Jan Vlieger, in his speech here at LSE 4 years ago. Moreover, the savings glut of the old seems to be particularly strongly felt in the space of safe assets like fixed income, as opposed to risky assets like equity, which may be a reflection of the variation in risk preferences across age groups. For that reason, this new aging pressure on returns to capital may be more powerfully and differentially felt on debt yields, and thus on our STAR, than on other asset returns. Now, we've also seen other savings glut pressures, and you know, I should mention those. Capital flows to poor countries in the 19th century were common, and even in the 20th century, in the 60s and 70s. But in recent decades, that's reversed. Capital has tended to flow in the other direction, uphill, as it were. Especially public savings in the form of foreign currency reserves and sovereign wealth funds, pushing their savings into the advanced economies, global forces that are now acting to push down our STAR. A further savings glut may be driven by inequality if the rich have higher propensities to save, and this force has also perhaps been in play. So summing up, if we look back at 800 years, what have we learned? I'll try to sum it up in 5 points. For most of our peacetime history over the last millennium, one or more of these five obstacles, these five conditions, was met. You had a poor financial contracting environment at some points. You had an inefficient or backward financial sector here and there, sometimes because, you know, it was backward for historical reasons, sometimes maybe policy was in the way. Third, an inability to save or incentives to do so. You were near subsistence or there were other difficulties. Fast economic growth, encouraging investment. There were periods of fast economic growth like the Industrial Revolution or the Trente Glorieuse, the period right after World War II. Or fifthly, strong demand for borrowing from abroad. All of those different stories have cropped up across those epochs as we told a narrative, right? Each of these forces acted during one or more phases of our long history to prop up, to push upward on the natural rate, our STAR. They came and went, but one by one they've gradually fallen away, and maybe for the first time in history, all five forces are absent. For maybe the first time ever, not a single one is with us. So, secondly, now looking forward, I think the absence of these five factors seems to me more likely to continue, at least in the near term. Those who believe our STAR may rise in the near future, which is not my view, presumably have strong reasons to think that some of these will reverse on some dimensions. So, I mean, let me speculate on where, if at all, that seems likely. I'm not going to speak to one or two or three. If we're going to have a collapse of the rule of law, then we'll have bigger things to worry about than our STAR. So, fine. A return to inefficient financial markets or going backwards also seems unlikely to me, and it would be rude to say so in the financial capital of the world here in London. The desire to save for retirement seems to be destined only to get stronger as aging progresses further all over the world, and it's progressing even faster in some parts of the world than it has here in the UK and other advanced economies. That leaves items 4 and 5. Could there be some reason for investment to support growth? Or could there be a reversal of the global savings glut in poorer countries? I think many people focus on item 4. We may see some updraft from new technologies, maybe for climate transition, maybe from AI. But based on the numbers I've seen, I think the investment needs may not match what we saw historically in peak investment ages, like in the 1800s or the mid-20th century, when heavy industrial and infrastructure needs were at their apex. So I'm a little bit skeptical about that. I wonder if anything, if item 5 might kick in, the possible reversal of capital flows from poor to rich countries. Now, of course, it will depend on how well each country can finance its own investments through home savings. their demographic shifts to aging may raise a question mark about that. We'll just have to see. And it will also matter just as much how the institutional environment adapts to boost growth and attract foreign investment in many of those middle and low income economies. But if they could attain best practice technologically, as some of those countries have through impressive leapfrogging and gaining traction to get up the escalator to middle and middle-high income levels, if that kicks in to gear for a meaningful range of countries on macro scale, then it would certainly be felt in global capital markets. I doubt it, but I would be happy to be proved wrong, especially as it would mean rapid economic development in many of the poorer places around the world. But that said, I think rather the 21st century, our star will be defined most of all by aging, demography, the greater, even greater savings glut of the old as even a global phenomenon, right? It hasn't yet spread to many countries, but it will be an important shift, and I think a bit of a scary shift, likely a big challenge for us all. Okay, we did a lot of talk, now we need to do some theory. We need to eat our broccoli now. Sorry, I often say that to my students. We've done some talk, now it's time for your broccoli. So back to our star. If it's not directly observable, how can we measure it? For that, we need a model. Most models of our star typically embody some economic theory of what the steady state might look like. For example, if we posit the steady state is one where demand and supply in the goods market are in balance, the output gap is closed, inflation is at target, there's some long-run trend, we'd estimate some structural model, we'd design a filter then to extract from that model using the data a real rate which is consistent with all of those conditions being true. Well, what I've just described is a version of probably the most well-known and widely used R-star model, the New York Fed or Laubach-Williams model, a semi-structural New Keynesian model. It has an unobserved time-varying trend, which is R-star, and you can back that out with a Bayesian statistical method, the Kalman filter. And lots of other R-star models, including my own, have subsequently built on this. My preference is for a two-block model, a macro block, and a finance block. The macro block is low frequency. It covers the two trends here, pi star, the inflation trend, r star, the real trend. Sorry, there has to be one equation. And then the finance block, which is measured by looking at the bond yields, it represents the cyclical fluctuations. There could be one or more factors there. Here, for the simplest case, there's just a single factor, the cyclical factor. And then from that, with sufficient theoretical structure, you can have a model of bond yields at any particular maturity, or here, as written, the average bond yield, which might stand for an average interest rate in the market. So that's the kind of modeling framework. What happens if you put this to use on the most recent data? Well, we've just updated these estimates at the bank up to the first quarter of 2025. I'll show estimates for a group of five countries, US, UK, Japan, France and Germany, going back to the 1990s. And these estimates are reasonably precise. And several features of this chart stand out. One is the sort of common trend. R-star has been on a strong downward trend in all of these countries. Second, real rates began here in positive territory, 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe 7%. But especially once we get past the financial crisis, around about here, rates are kind of collapsing down towards zero or even into negative territory for some countries. And then we're seeing a little bit of an uptick after the COVID pandemic, maybe here, you know, extra fear, extra precaution, savings really in excess supply, and then a bit of a rebound. So now we're maybe at levels comparable, say, to 2015 or so. Fourth, the overall ranking of rates today bears some intuitive relationship to fundamentals like growth rates and demography. So at the bottom here we have Japan and Germany, where growth and demography are less favorable at the top, UK and US, where growth and demography in relative terms are more favorable. Okay. So what might this imply for the neutral nominal rate? This is a real rate. Well, that point estimate at the end of our star for the UK is at about 0.75%. For Q1 2025, similar to the 2015 level. Adding 2% for our inflation target, we reach a nominal neutral rate of 2.75%. And around that, we might put a confidence band. I don't know what you want to go for, but maybe from 2.25 to 3.25. I don't think it's a particularly controversial or unusual range for such an estimate. In fact, I think it coincides with the FT's most recent UK estimate that Chris Giles put out in the most recent newsletter as to the terminal rate for the UK. Okay. Now, to conclude, on two happy notes, this model provides us with an endpoint for the interest rate, and therefore it provides me, or allows me to provide you, with an endpoint for this lecture. Should we end up in a state of the world where all shocks have mostly dissipated, which is a hypothetical question, I would expect bank rate to normalize at something close to this central estimate of 2.75%. That means with bank rate currently at 4.25, we still have a long way to go to get to neutral. Our current policy is therefore still quite restrictive, as we can see from this chart, which is expressed in real terms, not nominal terms. And it plots the UK path of our star, the trend, against, looking backwards, the ex post real short rate, and going forwards, what is implied by our May 2025 MPR forecast. And to say a little bit about that May forecast, there's a bump in inflation in 2025 due to some one-off factors like taxes and administered prices. So there may be a small excess of inflation over target as that falls away in 2026, which is why there's a dip in the real rate forecast at the start of this horizon. But by late 2026, we should again be very close to 2% inflation, according to our predictions, and the forecast sees a degree of slack opening up in the economy with unemployment rising to around 5%. So I would expect our policy rate, should those circumstances be close to true, to be also close to neutral, say around 3% by the end of 2026, even because inflation might still sit a little bit above target. But our forecast is based on a market curve that anticipates a much higher level of rates in 2026 and 2027, the terminal rate leveling off around there between 3.5% and 4%. And in my view, given the estimate of our star, that would imply continued restrictiveness in our monetary policy stance into the further future, as shown here. And that, to my mind, risks pushing the economy below target inflation and opening up an unduly large degree of slack. Now, those considerations informed my votes in May and June in the last two MPC meetings. So a little background on that and what comes next. In February and March, the earlier part of this year, I'd voted with the majority to make 0.25 percentage point cut in February and no cut in March. That is the so-called gradual quarterly pace of cuts that many observers have been expecting. So why was that? 6 months ago, I was sort of in wait-and-see mode. I wanted to let more data materialize because I wanted to understand the bump in inflation. I wanted to have more insight into wage and services inflation dynamics. And I hopefully wanted to get, I'm still hoping to get, more clarity on the uncertain and shifting global economic environment. We might learn more next week. But recently I felt more assurance on at least the first two domestic factors. The 2025 bump remains, but it's expected to subside when we get into next year. And incoming data suggest wage settlements of about 3.7% in 2025, a big step down from last year when they were close to 6% and close to a target consistent level. And labor market slack has now opened up and is expanding. Globally, well, trade war tensions remain despite the many pauses and both the uncertainty effect and I think the likely mechanics of trade frictions and trade diversion will be substantial in my mind and imply downside risks to our inflation forecast. So in the near term, I see stronger disinflationary forces building up and a need to reach for a lower neutral level over the course of 2026 and 2027, should we be able to normalize smoothly. And for those reasons, I was persuaded in May and June not only to vote for a lower level of bank rate, but also to signal the need for a lower rate path over the year to come, one that accords with my lower level of neutral. I also think that we remain restrictive, even at the moment, and you know, at 4.25 or even at 4%, such that for me, a better risk management approach would be to cut at this point and hold for longer later if necessary, rather than hold too much and then have to cut in a hurry later on. I think of that as a form of insurance of bringing the cut forward. Now, I'm near the end of this lecture, but I'm also near the end of my first year on the MPC. And over that time, much has changed. The balance of risks, I think, has shifted. We're having to look through a lot more noise. We're having to try to focus on the direction of the underlying trends at home and the mounting risks around the world. And these forces push in a direction that overall, I think, is weakening demand faster than supply and generating a lot of downside risk for our economy. Many could imagine a soft landing a year ago, but I think that soft landing is at risk. And I think right now some insurance is advisable. And I would say that macroeconomic history shows that insurance is best taken out sooner rather than later. Now, for sure, there'll be future shocks, and bank rate must react to them as they materialize to get the degree of restriction or accommodation right so that we can meet our inflation mandate. But as I've argued tonight, that's something that needs to be judged relative to neutral. So I'll leave you with what is, if you like, the paradox of monetary policy making. We know we will never see the end of the road, but we must always be looking for it. Thank you.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Alan, for this amazing course on the history of interest rates. We will now open the floor for questions. So we will be getting the microphones to Ben and the gentleman there. We'll take three questions. Yeah, and Charlie there. While that happens, please keep... Let me ask a quick question, because I was a bit puzzled by your graph with the comparison of interest rates across countries, since you're an international economist. The UK was at the top. Yeah, that would be great. The UK was at the top of the chart, and you put it down to the fact that it had more favorable growth and demographics. But can that really explain the fact that it's above the US, or what else is going on?
Yeah, I was merely making the comparison with Germany and Japan. So I think, you know, there are confidence intervals around those estimates, but I wouldn't read a lot into
Fair
that.
Enough.
Might be about 10 or 15 basis points difference.
Yeah, except that our growth hasn't been as stellar as the US, but fair enough. There are some errors. So let's start with Ben. Yeah.
Ben.
Thanks very much, Alan. That was great. Your fantastic historical graph covered such a long period of time that the what you call the blip between epochs one and two was actually about 50 years. And it's one where interest rates went up, actual interest rates and the estimate of R star. Probably because this country certainly was engaged, well, at least 50 years of wars and very high public deficits. And there were little spikes in particular wars, but over that period as a whole, certainly not just the Napoleonic Wars, but even before, interest rates were considerably higher than they had been 100 years earlier. And you don't need to fight a war to have high government deficits. Indeed, we're seeing pretty high government deficits right now, notably in the United States, but still in Europe. And whether or not for that reason, it is a fact that on indexed yields, bonds are saying that real interest rates will, I'm not saying they're right or wrong, I'm just saying that they have real interest rates significantly higher than your estimates of R star in just about every country there. So do you think those two things are linked? Do you think the scale of deficits is irrelevant because there's ex ante private saving and will swamp it? I'd like you to comment on government balance sheets.
Thank you, Ben. We'll take two more questions. Please tell us your affiliation and keep the questions short. The gentleman,
Thank you very, very much indeed, particularly the closing bouncing point. Ewan Grant, UK Defence Forum, I'll understand if you'd prefer not to answer this one. Has the MPC been modelling the consequences of an assault or strangulation of Taiwan, and whether that would be inflationary or deflationary, and presumably that would be on a essentially worldwide consequence impact?
Thank you. And we had Charlie here in the second.
Yeah, my question is, sorry?
And your name, Anna Phyllis.
Charlie B, LSE, ex-Bank of England, and ex-OBR for that matter. So my question is essentially really the same as Ben's. I was really struck by the absence of the public sector from your narrative, other than a passing reference to the Napoleonic Wars. And it does seem to me, in contemplating the forces that might be driving the natural rate going forward, that the public finances are quite likely to run, particularly given the passage of the big beautiful bill and what that means for the global demand for funds from the US. I'll make one other passing comment, which again picks up on something that you just said to Silvana. I think when people present charts like the one you have here, or the one that you've finished with, it really does behave you to put some standard errors on these. Because the thing about these estimates of the natural rate, the standard errors are huge, typically. And the way you presented things at the end gives a sort of misleadingly precise picture of our knowledge about what our star is.
Okay. So those are great questions, and
so I started to get nervous when Ben went in the direction of wanting me to comment on fiscal policy when he knows that I'm not in a position or well advised to do that. But then we got a question about defence, and I thought, oh well, even more things that I can't possibly comment on. But I'll say a couple of things. I think. There's always the question of, if you have wartime needs, the classic question in economic history is, do you fund that through debt issuance or do you fund that through taxation? And that's been true, as a sort of standard textbook exercise. So there isn't, a unique answer to that. And then to Charlie's question, actually, in this model and with this estimation, the standard errors are not huge. They're not 100, 200 basis points. They're probably around plus or minus 50, which is what I cited. I said it. 275 is my central estimate. There's some noise around that, but I don't think it's as wide as many would believe. And I think it's because this kind of model combines macro and financial market information. You're not just relying on one. So we can send you a copy of the paper with the confidence intervals, and maybe that'll make you happy.
Very good. We can have a couple more questions, and I'll read one from the. So let's give it to Jan and Mahmoud. No?
My question
is already answered. Very good. So the lady in the first. And I will read, meanwhile, one from our online viewers. Yes. How do you think, in the near future, due to geopolitical tensions abroad, will the monetary policy stance be affected in the UK?
Thank you, Bruna Skarkop, Morgan Stanley. Thanks for the comprehensive presentation. I think the full text of the speech and your remarks in Sintra earlier this week, I believe you mentioned a terminal in the UK to converge to your estimate of neutral of 275. You do mention, however, that you see slack opening up and expanding at the moment. So I was just wondering, how do you assess the risk of, or the rather the need, perhaps, to go below neutral, below 275, in order to close that output gap that you assess has opened and seems to be expanding, particularly in the labour market? Thank you.
The gentleman here.
Thank you very much, Professor Allen. As a Yorkshireman, I was really surprised that you didn't bring us down to earth by defining what the natural rate of interest is. Could you please answer that question? Thank you.
Thank you. So,
Okay. I'll go straight to the Yorkshire-based question. So the natural rate is, if the economy were in steady-state equilibrium without shocks buffeting it, what would be the interest rate in real terms that would equilibrate savings and investment so that market would be in balance, all other markets in balance, the economy is in a stable position? Of course, that's a theoretical construct, but it's there in the background, right? So, right. I mean, if you go out, a tree's blowing in the wind, like it was at Sintra this week, you never see the steady state position of the tree. It's constantly going like it. But there is a steady state position, and it's a real construct. Yeah. The question about terminal and downside risk. It gives me a chance to talk about recency bias, which was sort of in the background of my remarks at Sintra, right? So markets were constantly wrong during the 2010s. It was spectacular that policy rate stayed at zero, or close to the zero. In different countries, it was the effective lower bound. And it was just nailed to the floor. But markets kept on expecting liftoff, right? And so if you were a policymaker saying, let me base everything I do around the market path, you would have kind of been disappointed, and not as disappointed as the people in financial markets who were losing their jobs because they'd made all these wrong forecasts, but still, you'd have been disappointed. But is it a psychological recency bias? You think, oh, well, interest rates used to be here, therefore they must go back there. And as I said in Sintra, it was kind of ironic that when markets finally believed interest rates were going to stay low, that's when we had the pandemic and inflation blew up and rates had to go high. So, how am I addressing your question? I'm not, but now I'm going to address it, which is, I think you're referring to the downside path in my rate path chart at Sintra, which we now realize we should have maybe shown here, right? All we've talked about here is how fast do you get back to neutral, as if that's sort of like where we're going. But there are scenarios where, you know, bad things can happen. Growth can sputter. Inflation shocks can go down as well as up. And policy might then have to be appropriately accommodative, in other words, below neutral, right? This has happened many times in the past. We've had crises, we've had recessions, we've had shocks that have required that. For anyone out there who thinks that can't happen again, well, you know, I'd beg to differ, right? So we have to be prepared that that might materialize, and it has to be in the universe, the probability space in our heads as one possibility. Maybe not the baseline, but I think we need to be ready for that. Oh, and I just want to, since someone asked an online question, on geopolitical risk, I think that's sort of, wherever you are, thank you, I think that's embedded in some of our economic scenarios. So if we're thinking about modeling the impact of tariffs and trade wars and how that would kind of spill over onto a small, very open trading economy like the UK, we are going through modeling those kinds of scenarios, and that's one dimension of kind of geopolitical risk that now is suddenly in our modeling that wouldn't have been there 5 or 10 years ago.
So we have Jacqueline, Mahmoud, Angel, and meanwhile I will read one from the online viewers. Andrew Bailey said this week, there is too much uncertainty to give an estimate for our star. How do you respond to that, and would you urge your colleagues to publish their estimate also? A question from Tom Rees.
This is a question from Tom. Thank you, Tom. Much appreciated.
Let's wait for the others. And
really quickly, thanks, Alan. Absolutely fantastic. Jacqueline at Barclays. I just wondered how sensitive you think your kind of assessment on R-Star is to the fact that you close out the model with 2% inflation at target rather than, you know, potentially using medium-term inflation expectations measures, which have kind of been a little bit higher, a little bit more sensitive to kind of what's happened in spot inflation. Is it, you know, that those kind of variations don't make much of an impact, or theoretically would you not count them, or do you actually think that's something to be paying attention to?
Angel and Mahmoud. Can you pass it, Jack?
Angel with the front citadel. Alan, I'm looking at that chart, and from a historical standpoint, what would be the intuition by which Japan had much higher real neutral rate than the United States over a decade, right? The pink line is above the light blue line since 2005 to 2015. It cannot be demographics, cannot be inflation. I don't think it can be productivity. So, you know, do you have a story? Thank you.
Thank you. Mahmoud Pradhan from Amundi Asset Management. Thank you. I really enjoyed the presentation. A hypothetical, and it's similar to the governor's quote that was just quoted. You've made a very convincing case that this is one way, or at least it's a convincing case of how you judge, once you have this estimate, of how restrictive policy might be, and then over time where we're heading. Towards the end of your talk, you gave a whole range of factors that you're looking at, as many policymakers do. Mm-hmm. If there are colleagues of yours or other monetary policymakers who don't use this kind of approach to find their anchor, where they're heading, are they disadvantaged? How disadvantaged are they if they're not using this kind of framework to... Thank you.
I'll talk about maybe an interesting presentation that you should go and watch that was at Sintra a couple of days ago by Anna Saim of the Riksbank. And so they're a good example of what I would call full transparency, publishing the rate path, putting down their long-run neutral estimate, publishing that and standing by it. I'm a very transparent person. I'm actually apologizing for not putting my rate path chart up this evening already. I think we are well served if we publish that, and we've got a committee and we have a range of views, and it would be good for everyone to see that range. And I think overall the MPC is very good at, being open and transparent, and the role of the external members contributes to that, and it's one of the special things about the Bank of England. But I don't think we need to be afraid of our own shadow. As I said in Sintra, making a forecast or putting out your R star is a little bit like playing cricket. You expect to get out. Every time you walk out to bat, you should expect to get out pretty much. So you should expect your forecast to be wrong. But the Monetary Policy Committee is like an exercise in aggregation or wisdom of crowds, or it's a very small crowd, but we're hoping that through the median voter or through the collection of that wisdom, we will arrive at some estimate that makes sense given our distribution. But I think it's an aid to communication if we're very, very open about that. I happen to think, as I said to Charlie, that I think our estimates are more precise than some people would say on the critical side, but I also don't think they're, highly precise. I think they're one of the useful guides. My Sintra speech had some empirical exercises trying to show that, in fact, the R-star models are no worse and, in most cases, historically in recent decades, better than the market path at predicting what comes next. So, okay, we seem happy talking about the market path, but okay, let's run a horse race. It doesn't do that great. So, I would say I don't think I'm right. I think our job is to collectively find the right place, but we shouldn't be afraid to put our views out there, because I think that contributes to public understanding in the financial markets and elsewhere.
We have time for a couple more questions. So we have David there, and let's pick those two on the corner. And David first, here.
Thank you. David Robinson, Market News. Sorry, just following on from your reference to the Riksbank there, they publish a collective rate path, and they based a model-based, the R-star new rate is model-based and collective. As we know from the MPC, it's very hard to get agreement on anything. So we can have an Alan Taylor R-star and an Alan Taylor rate path. How do you envisage getting around that problem? We don't end up with 9 R-stars or 9 separate rate paths. Thank you.
My question is that what I was wondering is, you've said that there are assumptions that we're having an aging society, that we're having various demographic pressures. What I'm wondering is if there's a fear that some of these assumptions aren't entirely correct. Not that society isn't aging, but that actually the move by many governments towards populism, I think plans for zero net migration being thrown around, things like that. Is that going to lead to some of these figures being revised? Is that going because of the acceleration in the aging of society and the shrinking of the workforce and the falling of demand?
Thomas Obitz, you have packed your risk aversion of a market into this stochastic epsilon, right? Now,
when I'm looking at these rates here for Germany and the huge divergence between, on the one hand, the bank rates and, on the other hand, the stock markets in that region, is this level of risk aversion, which, on the other hand, basically means a higher risk premium for risky investments, might that be a structural feature of a market which needs to or can be included in a model in some way?
And before that, I will squeeze in one from the online viewers. Brian Moyer wants to know what would be the impact of U.S. tariffs on the natural rate of interest.
Okay, so great questions. Thank you. On the Riksbank, and can we communicate our views individually and collectively in a coherent fashion? I don't think the answer to that is not communicating them, but that's because I'm a transparency advocate. And the Riksbank isn't the only example. I gave that because I thought it was a particularly clear, clear presentation, a very transparent view that was given in Sintra. But there are other options, like you were worried about 9 R-stars and 9 paths. Well, how many do we get from the Fed in the dot plot? Even more, right? Twice as many. So there are other mechanisms to show the range of views. But I think that's okay, and it's communicating some of the uncertainty, of which there's quite a lot at the moment, and at the same time yet giving everyone a view as to what we think the central tendency might be. So I see that as a feature, not as a bug. The question about U.S. tariffs, that was interesting. I mean, we are right now, I mean, I've just come out of like a couple of meetings where we were discussing that today. It's going into our deliberations for every round now, with constant updates to what is trade policy now, what is it going to be tomorrow or next week. We're constantly trying to figure out where the directional impact will be on the UK economy, right? So it's not going to be the case that, well, we got a relatively low tariff and so we're out of the woods. I mean, we're a small economy. There's going to be spillover effects through third countries. How does the US tariffs versus China, where do they end up versus Japan versus the EU? The EU is a major trading partner. And so that's a very complex set of interlinkages to think about. What will be the impact on economic growth and performance, but also the impact on inflation? If goods cannot get into the US, where will they go? Will they come here? Will that depress our prices? How much? Will there be offsetting effects from the exchange rate or not? How much? So I can tell you we're actively working on that, and that's a big part of my bandwidth right now is trying to think about that particular problem, which I think is much harder than some of the other problems we're trying to deal with.
Well, thank you very much, Alan, for a fantastic lecture and insightful answers. And thank you, everyone here and online for the questions. Have a great evening.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events Podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.